Good morning, Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court, Santino Chakoti, on behalf of the appellant, Keen Thomas. The lone issue on appeal involves the denial of a motion to suppress in the Superior Court from evidence stemming from a procedurally defective search and seizure. The argument made in the court below, which we make here, is that Mr. Thomas' detention was unconstitutional at its inception from the contact of Detective Jordan. And the search thereafter is tainted by such illegality, regardless of consent. Detective Jordan did not possess the requisite specificity required that articulable suspicion demands. He had a very generic description throughout the record. It's essentially conceded that the description possessed was extremely general. General facts of an African-American male, mid-20s, dark clothing. The officers at the suppression hearing agree that the individuals that were seized at that moment that Mr. Thomas was seized all appeared with the same general description. Henceforth, that's why the group was seized. For that reason, Mr. Thomas's rights under the Delaware Constitution and the U.S. Constitution were violated. The inquiry begins with the seizure, as that's where the Fourth Amendment and the Delaware Constitution becomes relevant. For this purpose, under this set of facts, the seizure, the court need only look as far as the affidavit of probable cause. This court in McDonald made it rather expressly clear that the lower court's determination of a constitutional, whether it be probable cause for search and seizure, need only work for the affidavit of probable cause and the four corners test, because often memories become confused or unreliable the further from the search and from the inception that the seizure took place. In this case, there isn't, McDonald lends quite support in that the same fears that the court had in McDonald are present here. Because in this case, Officer Genevieve actually read her testimony from her affidavit of probable cause. She couldn't recall when she was asked by the prosecutor what occurred. She had to read verbatim the affidavit of probable cause.
Can we raise the mic just a bit?
Sure. The volume? I'm sorry. The volume?
No, or that better?
The volume.
The volume needs to go up.
Where's the volume on? Let's see.
All right. We'll just do the best we can then. We're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
Okay. I'll try to get closer. Is that better? Is that a little better?
It seems to be a bit better.
Okay. If there is a volume, then I guess there isn't. So I apologize. Going back to McDonald, this case presents the same reasons or concerns that McDonald, this court expressed in McDonald. If this court need only look as far as the affidavit of probable cause in this case, where Officer Jordan approached Mr. Thomas, and as the affidavit asserts, was told that he was going to conduct a pat-down search. Mr. Thomas was seized as soon as at that moment, and actually when the officers arrived at the scene to conduct what was de facto a raid. It was essentially a raid. Multiple assisting units arrived at the destination and began their investigation right then and there. Based on the fact that the seizure lacked reasonable articulable suspicion at that moment, the search that followed, whether it was given with consent or not, and we certainly don't concede that there was consent, at that moment the search was invalid.
What was the trial judge's finding on whether or not there was consent to the search?
That brings up an interesting point, Chief, with respect to the judge's findings. It's problematic for multiple reasons. To answer your question directly, the court somehow attached the normal practices of this officer as to what he did historically to prove that of what he did in this case. However, as the affidavit alludes to, he was told that he was going to conduct a pat-down search, and he performed it. There was no indication in the affidavit of probable cause whether Mr. Thomas gave consent. And at the suppression hearing, the testimony confirms that he could not remember whether he received consent or if Mr. Thomas just acquiesced to the officers engaging in the pat-down search. The other reason that the standing on the trial court's reasoning and decision, one of the most problematic issues with the decision is that it starts off with the proper analysis, and that is the question is whether there's reasonable articulable suspicion to stop this particular defendant. However, the court deviates drastically and begins that to find the totality of the circumstances of reasonable articulable suspicion to seize the entire group. There is nothing in the record that would lend support to any suspicion about a group of individuals engaged in any illegal activity.
Can I stop you at that point? Because as I understand the record, there was very clear reasonable articulable suspicion that one person, as it turns out, your client, had been involved in a drug transaction, right? Because he was being watched and went to the house, and that was consistent with what the officer was told would happen, and then he went to this open area drug place after being in the house for a few minutes, and that was consistent. So would you agree that there was reasonable articulable suspicion that one person in that group was the person that had been followed by the police officer and was about to commit a crime?
Our position is that we do not concede that there was articulable suspicion with Mr. Thomas. To answer your question, there's more suspicion with Mr. Thomas than a group of individuals. There was surveillance. Your Honor is correct. There was information that Mr. Thomas may be involved in some type of illegal activity. Whether that rose to articulable suspicion is debatable. The record has some problems whether, as it turns out, Mr. Thomas didn't actually go to the destination that the confidential informant alluded to.
Okay, well, then let me give you a hypothetical instead of trying to get you to concede any facts on this case. The hypothetical is that the police have reasonable articulable suspicion that one of a group of five or six similarly dressed and similarly identifiable people at this location is dealing drugs. So we assume that the police have such a reasonable articulable suspicion.
Sure.
With respect to a group of people, but only that one of those group of people is the person who's dealing the drugs.
Yes.
Would that in turn be enough to create a reasonable articulable suspicion that since one of these people is the drug dealer, I have enough to go on to stop all of these people to pursue the matter?
Right. And the answer to that question is no. You do not impute reasonable suspicion with a group or all to one. The law is rather clear in this area that from Terry and all of its progeny, the articulable suspicion is specific, and it demands specificity for that individual. In this case, it's arguable whether there was suspicion, but it was only attached to Mr. Thomas. That is clear. The affidavit is clear. The testimony is clear. All of the articulable suspicion was with Mr. Thomas. The problem here is that what we have is essentially a public roundup. We have 5 to 7 people outside of a restaurant, and they're all patted down, investigated, and probably what's most disturbing is that the officers did not even comply with 1902, which, if he's got reasonable articulable suspicion, then certainly continue the inquiry, ask for identification, ask for your business abroad, and then proceed from that point forward. Here we have essentially an unlawful seizure jumped into an immediate pat-down without any information that it was Mr. Thomas. In fact, Detective Jordan found out it was Mr. Thomas after he was handcuffed.
So was there sufficient information to allow a 1902 stop?
What information, Your Honor?
To allow a stop of Thomas under 1902, even though he was not known to be Thomas.
No, and the reason is because it was a random stop. He didn't know he had Thomas. 1902 would have permitted articulable suspicion, had he had it, that this particular individual was Thomas. At that point, he can further provide an inquiry as to his business abroad, proper identification. He can prolong the investigation. But the problem is this search is tarnished from its inception. It was premised on an unlawful seizure from the moment he randomly sought out Mr. Thomas. And this court asked for supplemental briefing in U.S. v. Brown, the Third Circuit opinion. That case has many parallels to this case. But with respect to 1902 and Justice Ridgely's question, with respect to what's the protocol if we apply the standard of 1902, and this is what the state misses in all of their briefing. It doesn't address what is probably the seminal point in Hensley and U.S. v. Brown, which cites Hensley, and that is if there is reasonable articulable suspicion from one officer to another, you can impute it, it's on page 233 of the Hensley opinion. The court concluded that if there is reasonable suspicion for this individual, it justifies a stop to check identification, pose questions to the person, and detain them briefly while obtaining further information. That's what's lacking here. That is essentially 1902. What the U.S. Supreme Court is acknowledging is if Officer A has reasonable suspicion and wants to pass it along to Officer B, if Officer B wants to impute that reasonable suspicion and apply it, he still must perform the basis under 1902, which is essentially a codification of Terry. It just codifies Terry. That's what's lacking here. You cannot neglect or circumvent the principles from Terry that are codified in 1902 simply because one officer has reasonable articulable suspicion. What we're essentially doing is giving carte blanche to officers to conduct public roundups, which is what happened here.
Mr. Trotty, let me interrupt you at this point and ask you a hypothetical so that I can make sure I understand your position.
Certainly.
Let's assume that officer number one has a reasonable articulable suspicion that a particular defendant is about to commit a crime. But officer number one is not in a position to make a stop or to do a search or seizure because of distance, and so calls officer number two, says, you have to help me you know, I want you to stop this particular person, but doesn't tell officer number two all the reasons. So officer two is basically relying, you know, on officer number one without having all of the facts that are in the head of officer one. My question is the knowledge of officer one imputed to officer two for purposes of determining the validity of the stop?
The answer to your question harps on the language in Hensley, and also that's in U.S. v. Brown, Your Honor, and that is he can rely on it up to a point. It does not give him carte blanche to pull out this individual and begin doing anything that Officer 1, in your scenario, would be able to do. It compels the 1902 principles, which is essentially Terry, to control.
I'm not sure I understand that answer. Either there is attribution or there isn't. If there is attribution, that is, if the adequate knowledge, which that is the reasonable and articulable suspicion of Officer 1 is imputed to Officer 2, then that's the end of the analysis, I would think. If it isn't, then there would have to be a separate determination of whether or not Officer 2 had a reasonable and articulable suspicion. So I gather that the answer to my question, and it's a hypothetical, is no, there is no attribution. Is that a fair statement?
Hensley and Brown, which cite for the same proposition, and I apologize if I'm not answering Your Honor's question directly. The proposition in those cases, officers can rely on the bulletins or flyers of other officers based on reasonable suspicion. The problem becomes, though, after they stop, again, these are random stops, Officer B, in your hypothetical, doesn't know who the individual is.
I understand that, but I've eliminated that in my hypothetical. I'm assuming just one suspect.
Okay, so I apologize. So if I'm understanding your question correctly, both officers know of the individual?
Yes.
Then certainly. Then the answer would be he can rely. And your hypothetical is different from this situation where Officer B does not know. That's my point. In this case, Officer B did not have the information that Officer A had. I see I'm into my rebuttal.
I want to save the balance of
your time. Certainly, sure. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to first thank Your Honors for allowing our law clerks to sit in and to speak, and Justice Holland particularly for speaking with them before I arrived. Your Honor, addressing Justice Jacob's question in the first instance, this is what Your Honor posed was precisely the situation in Hensley. Mr. Thomas misconstrues Hensley in that no matter what Officer 1 had, Officer 2 is limited to a 1902 stop. What Hensley has subsequently been interpreted as saying in Miller and in the other cases cited by the state is that whatever Officer 1 would have been justified in doing, Officer 2 may do that same and no more. So if the first officer had only reasonable articulable suspicion, the second officer, unless they add to that knowledge, does not have probable cause.
So you're saying there would be attribution?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a direct pass-through. In Hensley, it was a bulletin put out. This person is wanted for information regarding a robbery. It didn't say that he was a suspect, didn't say that he was the perpetrator, didn't convey any level of knowledge that would be, this is a person I can arrest based on this requirement. However, certainly, if the bulletin is, arrest this person, the second officer can arrest that person, and then the analysis has to flow back to the first officer.
So let me just make sure I have your argument. You're saying that since officer number one, in this case, Jean-Bier, would have known precisely whom to stop because she had been investigating this defendant, that she would have done so, and therefore we have to assume that officer two could have done so as well had he known.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but he didn't know.
Well, Your Honor, contrary to my colleague's argument, the bulletin put out here contained Mr. Thomas's name, date of birth, age, or approximate height and weight, race, clothing, precise destination, and the vehicle in which he was riding. It was a very specific tip. The fact that once they arrived, there were more than one person who met that physical description does not necessarily invalidate the stop entirely.
Well, let's go back to what everyone agrees on, which seems to be that you can attribute knowledge between the police officers. But the one thing that the second police officer didn't have is the identity. So the second police officer stops the group. And as I understand it, since many people in the group, several people in the group match the description, he decided to go through the group one by one, and it just so happened that he started with Thomas. Is that right on the facts?
In terms of whether he intended to go through one by one, or if, I guess the description is later on, someone would go through and get everybody's name and identification.
Well, and as I understand the argument from Mr. Thomas is, attribution is fine, and it justifies a stop perhaps, but it doesn't necessarily justify the stop of a group. And even if it does justify the stop of a group, once the stop has occurred, you have to look at 1902 and go through the questioning before you get to the pat down. So just parsing the facts of this case, the focus of Mr. Thomas seems to be, I don't think you could stop the group. But even if you stopped the group, you should have started with the questioning rather than the pat-down. Is that the way you understand his argument?
Your Honor, my understanding of his argument was that attribution is actually not okay, that Detective Jean-Vier's extensive police work in this case, which established probable cause, not reasonable articulable suspicion, need be ignored here.
All right, well, let's...
Assuming Your Honor...
Let's go forward in the inquiry. You've now stopped the group.
Yes, Your Honor.
And assume for purposes of my question, the stop of the group is legitimate. Once you've stopped someone, can you skip the questioning in 1902 and go straight to a pat down? And if you can, don't you have to have a reason such as officer safety for going straight to the pat down?
Well, in the first instance, Your Honor, yes, it would be preferable to do the 1902 questions.
So the statute is optional?
It would be preferable, it's not necessary to do that first before moving on.
To the pat-down?
To the pat-down. In this instance, the trial court found that he consented to the pat-down. That finding was not clearly erroneous. But in this instance, under these circumstances, where we have a member of the Wilmington Drug Task Force who's been specifically advised that a person is in this particular neighborhood with a very high quantity of heroin.
I know, but let's come back to the facts of this case, which is he has a group in front of him. My question is, how do you go immediately to a pat down, and what's the basis for skipping the questioning?
Your Honor, in terms of the speed of this, this all took place within a minute, approximately. This is an officer safety pat down. If he had not consented, it was an officer safety pat-down. Given the knowledge, he met the description that was communicated. This was a drug case. Drug defendants are often armed. This was purely for officer safety on that basis. However, here, Mr. Thomas consented. So the basis would be, based on the totality of the circumstances here, it was a drug case, high quantity of heroin, high crime neighborhood.
So number one, there was consent for doing the pat-down out of order, out of the natural order. But even if there wasn't consent, the out-of-sequence pat-down was justified on the basis of officer safety.
On the basis of officer safety and on the basis that he met the description communicated by...
Was there a finding by the court, by the trial court, on the officer safety matter?
No, the trial court found that he consented. It need not reach that particular issue.
What were the... I'll ask you the same question I asked your colleague. What were the facts on which the trial judge based the conclusion that Thomas had consented to the court?
The facts were Detective Janvier's testimony. I would agree with Mr. Chakotay that it is not in the affidavit of probable cause that he consented. At the suppression hearing, Detective Janvier said that it is Detective Jordan's normal practice to ask to seek consent before patting somebody down for officer safety. And Detective Jordan, while he did not recall, testified that it is his normal practice to ask, and though he did not recall, this was 8 months after the incident, and he was called in on relatively short notice.
So apparently it wasn't in his police report as well as not in his affidavit, so he had no basis to refresh his recollection about what actually happened.
No, Your Honor.
And that's the basis on which the trial judge relied.
The basis was Detective Janvier's testimony, Detective Jordan's testimony, and the understanding that is Detective Jordan's normal practice. That is the basis for the consent.
Well, how does that unequivocally show that there was a consent?
Your Honor, certainly his normal practice is relevant. Detective Janvier's testimony that he got consent was also relevant.
But how did the detective know he got consent?
I would assume, Your Honor, that it was conveyed. She arrived somewhere 30 seconds, 45 seconds after.
How do you assume that? These people write police reports that document what they did and how they did it and the response of the defendant. There's also an affidavit of probable cause here. And what the trial judge had before the court was the defendant's denial that he had consented, as I understand the record, and a factual basis that said, it's what I normally do. I must have done it here, but I really don't recall.
Your Honor, first, there was no objection to Detective Janvier's statement that he had consented at trial. There was no objection to that.
Well, the question is, what weight should be given to it in terms of making a factual finding that there was consent by the defendant to the pat-down search?
You know, Your Honor, if I may, the issue of consent, while it was a finding of the trial court, it's not critical to the affirmance of this case or denial of this case. The fact is that whether he consented or not, he was going to be searched when Detective Jordan went up to him on the basis of the probable cause.
I appreciate that's your position, but the record would at least suggest to me that the trial judge thought it was important, because that's the critical finding that the trial judge made, that the defendant consented to the search. So once the trial judge concludes that the defendant consented, why explore other arguments for why it was a valid search and seizure?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that the trial judge's finding was, and I also find that he consented, after finding that the stop was justified by, at that point, reasonable articulable suspicion. And I also found that he consented.
Well, but I thought you, and this is, you know, further explore the Chief Justice's question. I thought in response to my question, you said the trial court made no finding that the pat-down was justified or would have been justified absent consent on the basis of officer safety.
No, the trial judge, you're correct, Your Honor. I did not mean to give that that misapprehension.
So the officer safety argument is basically the state's suggestion of an alternative ground for affirmance.
Well, that was the testimony of the officers at the trial, was that it was officer safety. The state's position with regard to affirmance is he could be arrested, Mr. Thomas could be arrested by Detective Janvier. Detective Jordan is solely a tool of Detective Janvier, that this has to pass directly through so long as what Detective Jordan did not exceed the grounds of what Detective Janvier could have done. And well, Detective
could the officer on the scene have basically called for a paddy wagon? And said, how many people were there? Seven or eight? However many there were, all of you in this wagon. We're going down to the police station and sort this out, who's who.
Well, Your Honor, certainly to the extent that they met the description of the reasonableness of those individual searches would have to be evaluated on those individual seizures. I'm sorry. To the extent they met the description and Detective Janvier's developed probable cause, yes, they could have taken all of them into custody at that time.
Would you explain to me if there's six or seven people there, all of whom meet roughly the description of the person that the officer on the scene was looking for, he was only concerned for his safety with the first one he picked out? What about the other five or six?
Your Honor, he didn't pick them out. There were other officers on the scene who had gone up to the other people on the scene. Detective Jordan only dealt with Mr. Thomas. It was not, he didn't go between the other individuals there. It was once Detective Janvier arrived, the others were let go, and Detective Janvier took Mr. Thomas because she could identify him.
If I understand your argument correctly, it seems as if you're saying in a circumstance like this where there are a group of people of similar description, one of those people the police have an articulable suspicion about, the others the police know nothing about and have no reason to believe have committed a crime or about to commit a crime, nothing. And that the way this was approached is that one police officer went to each of these individuals and patted them down and stopped them and seized them. And so out of, say, seven people, there were six illegal seizures, but the one person who got the suspect that they were looking for, that was a legal seizure. Is that the gist of it?
No, Your Honor. They were all, to the extent that all these people were seized and they met the description, they were all legal seizures. And we can look in Brown and what happened there to see where it could become an illegal seizure. The men that were seized there did not meet the description, not even remotely. They were between almost twice the age of the people that were described. The location description was based on, at best, secondhand information of someone who had never seen these people. And it was based on an extraordinarily generic description of two young African-American males who attempted to rob me. There was nothing supporting that stop. That stop was illegal. Here, to the extent that these men matched, the five or seven men matched the description conveyed by Detective Janvier.
Only because it was a pretty generic one.
Well, it wasn't, Your Honor, I would suggest that it wasn't very generic. It was precise age, race, clothing, so location.
These were all clones with, you know, some minor variations.
Well, Your Honor, I understand it sounds a bit far-fetched, but the testimony at trial was that these five to seven people met the description that was conveyed. The fact is that Detective Janvier, once she arrived 30 to 45 seconds later, was able to distinguish the person that she needed. But for that to happen, the officers have to have the ability to stop the people there so that they can distinguish who is the person they're looking for from the people that they're not.
So I can get a better feel for the need to protect the police officers. How many police officers arrived at the same time, and how many people were there when they arrived?
There's not testimony as to how many officers arrived. It was the call went out to the entire undercover vice unit in the area.
Yeah, because I had gotten the impression from your earlier comment that it was basically one-on-one, a police officer for each of the suspects who met the description.
That would be a fair reading of the record, yes. And there were five to seven. There are varying descriptions. Five to seven seems to be the common thread of the number of people who were at this particular corner at this particular time.
Five to seven potential suspects, and then five to seven officers arrive all at the same time, except for Janvier, who comes 20 seconds later?
Yes.
Is that what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. Detective Janvier was driving an unmarked, unlighted vehicle, so she got delayed by traffic. That was her testimony. The rest of the officers either were able to get there faster in their unmarked vehicles. I believe at least Detective Jordan's testified that he was in an unmarked vehicle.
Well, help me out here. Your analysis was that the officer who actually stopped this defendant could lawfully have done whatever Officer Janvier could have done. The problem I have with that analysis is that Officer Janvier would have gone directly to this particular suspect and proceeded from there. But that's not what happened here. That is, the arresting officer didn't know who it was. Doesn't that require, doesn't that break whatever attribution of knowledge that would otherwise shield this particular officer from the claims that are being made here?
Certainly not, Your Honor, because the whole purpose of the Hensley, Miller, and that line of cases is that one officer, no matter how far from the original arresting or detaining the person developing the cause to stop this person, should be able to rely on that, and that should not be an illegal stop. The mere fact that Detective Janvier was at best or at worst 45 seconds behind should not then make what Detective Jordan did illegal. He had to stop.
Well, your analysis holds up only if the stop of all of the potential suspects and what proceeded from that was legal. Is that right?
Your Honor, I would suggest that no, that the analysis can be confined to Detective Jordan's stop of.
Well, then aren't we back to Justice Berger's question? That is, don't we have a situation where all of the stops were illegal except for the one stop that mattered of this defendant?
No, Your Honor, I would say under these circumstances that the stop of the entire group was justified. The arrest of Mr. Thomas was justified by the stop. Whether there would have been justification for arrest of the entire group is a more detailed question. But the arrest of Thomas here was justified by Detective Janvier's information. And this court said that 30 years ago in Cooley.
You've only got 30 seconds left, but can you tell me again why 1902 and its four questions are discretionary? Police officers can follow that statute or not, depending on their whim.
Your Honor, it's not based on their whim. Certainly under the circumstances here, where, again, we have a rapidly evolving situation where it's the Detective Jordan has to ensure his safety. This is, again, a drug case with a lot of people in a very bad neighborhood, and he's been called immediately go to this place. He's certainly reasonable in believing that he should pat somebody down to ensure his own safety. And
so,
1902.
So that analysis would then extend to the point where, in any case where drugs are the subject of the investigation, 1902 is off the books.
Certainly not, Your Honor, but the state.
So, well, in every drug case, we hear that the officer has reason to fear for his safety because drugs are always accompanied by weapons.
Well, Your Honor, I see that I'm beyond my
time. I know you are.
The circumstances here suggested to Detective Jordan that he should pat down Mr. Thomas. Whether that would apply to any and all drug cases is a question for that particular tribunal, seeing those facts at that time.
If he took the time to ask for consent, but he didn't take the time to ask your name and what is your business abroad, is that correct?
Yes, and certainly it would have been better had he done so. However, it should not be fatal to the search here.
I think Justice Drizley may have had a question.
My question is, what are the limits to your analysis when, as far as seizure of a group, would it extend to the entire block, a neighborhood, when there's a generic description? Where do you draw the line?
Well, Your Honor, the behavior of the seizing officer has to be rationally justified by the report. Here the report was, this corner, at this time, this description. If the description was in the entire neighborhood of Riverside, would it have justified rounding up the entire neighborhood of Riverside? No. That would have been unreasonable reliance on what was conveyed, because the information conveyed was specific. The reasonableness of it depends on whether the officer's conduct was rationally related to the report. And the report here was this person, this place, this time, wearing this clothing, this height, this weight, it arriving in this car at approximately a minute from now.
Now, do you agree, though, that the officer could not articulate a suspicion as to the initial person he sees any different from anyone else who was present?
To the extent that the other people matched the description, no. He had the state would not even remotely suggest that Detective Jordan had any independent basis aside from Mr. Thomas met the description to approach him in particular. Thank you, Your Honors.
I feel like I should start with the concerns from Justice Jacobs and Justice Holland, which, again, is this notion of this imputed reasonable suspicion. And I think the best way to clarify that, and I apologize if I wasn't clear the first time when I answered Your Honor's questions, is probably to pose a hypothetical on the flip side. Let's assume that Detective Janvier did arrive, and that it wasn't Detective Jordan. Would Detective Janvier have been permitted to randomly, let's assume he didn't know he had Thomas, as Jordan didn't know. Would that enable him to perform immediate pat-down searches without asking who he had? And I think that question is answered pretty easily, is he wouldn't be allowed. That's the same reason that Detective Jordan could not do it, because even if Janvier got there first, he still has to know that he has Mr. Thomas. We're assuming that if he's there, he can immediately ascertain he's got Mr. Thomas in front of him. But let's assume he just does a random pat-down without knowing he has Mr. Thomas. That's what happened here. It was done in such a hasteful manner that he did not have the reasonable articulable suspicion. And that is what is fatal in the state's case. Unless the court has any other questions.
Was there sufficient reasonable articulable suspicion to do a 1902 stop of what the individual who turned out to be Thomas?
No. No.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to recess.